All right, everyone. Hello. Welcome to our monthly membership meeting, the Awakening Together membership meeting for May 2014. So tonight I think what I'm going to talk about is a little bit about what's happening here in Colorado with the Choose Again retreat, which started yesterday. I think also we'll probably look forward to the Awakening Together Satsang Retreat that is happening in September. But first, I'm going to tell you about one more thing. One more thing that I think hasn't really been formally announced yet, but it's going to be announced, I would think, sometime soon. And that is the biannual A Course in Miracles conference that is put on by Community Miracle Center. As you all know, for several years, that conference was held typically in February, I think, in San Francisco. But last year, it was held in April in Chicago. And it is going to be held next April, April of 2015. And it will be in New York City. And in fact, let me just take a moment to pull up my calendar here and I can give you the exact dates because I do have it marked on my calendar because they've asked me to come and represent Awakening Together, which is a little bit funny, actually, because I had no intention of ever speaking at this conference again. And in fact, I had a breakfast meeting with Tony last year explaining to him that I was not interested in speaking in this conference again. But when they sent me the email and asked me if I would represent Choose Again at the conference next year, a yes came anyway. So, the dates are going to be, it's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It will be April 17, 18, and 19, 2015 in New York City. April 17, 18, and 19, in New York City. So I'm sure that they'll start putting out formal information soon. I don't know anything else about who's going to be there. I have been told the name of the hotel, but I don't remember the details. It's supposed to be a very nice hotel. Personally, I've never been to the city. I was asked to represent Awakening Together. Did I say Choose Again? I'm representing Awakening Together. The Pennsylvania Hotel, Dove says. Yes, I was asked to represent Awakening Together. Not Choose Again. But I do have Choose Again on the brain, so I can see why I may have had a tongue slip there. I have Choose Again on the brain because they're here. People began to arrive on Thursday for Choose Again. Diedrich Woolsack, Claudette Thomas, and one of their staff members named Dave Vass arrived on Thursday night, and they spent a couple of nights here at my house in preparation for the retreat, and then yesterday the retreat began. And again, it's a full house. I don't think we could have fit another person in the door, to be honest. if you look at the room where the circles are held, the chairs go all the way around the room, you know, at the biggest circumference, one next to the other, and there's not even an opening so people can get in and out the door. It's a closed circle because there just isn't room for an opening. So it's as full as it could be if you're going to sit in a circle in that room. Altogether, there are 21 participants and 5 staff members for a total of 26 people that are at the retreat. And I thought what I would do is just since you all weren't able to go to the retreat, I thought I would start by just sharing a little bit with you about Choose Again. Of course, I know we've had Diedrich here before, but now you're going to get Choose Again through the filter of Regina Don Akers. I have a little workbook with me, which is called Choose Again, There Is a Better Way. This is the workbook that they use in their retreats. And, one thing that's in the workbook, there are pages and pages in the workbook of quotes. You know, like, here's a quote. This is from page 18 in the workbook. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. And that's a quote from A Course in Miracles. The way the circle started this morning was there was a particular paragraph. It wasn't this one I opened randomly just now, but it was another paragraph from A Course in Miracles that Diedrich, I don't know if he selected or if he randomly opened, but he asked everyone in the room to read. But the way it happened was we passed one book around the room and each person read that same paragraph. So since there were 26 people in the room, we listened to that paragraph be read 26 times. Now, you know, I can't be sure that everyone was listening. Some people may have been thinking about other things if it wasn't their turn. But if you just sat and listened to anything being read 26 times, the meaning of that thing becomes deeper and deeper and more ingrained and more ingrained. In fact, sometimes I tell the story of a man named Samuel Williams who he went to China on a spiritual retreat. And he was with a master there, and the master there gave him just a little one-line quote and asked him to share what that quote meant. And Samuel Williams says he looked at it for a moment and then was ready to share, and the master stopped him and said, no, and told him he had, I think it was 28 days to contemplate that one line. And after 28 days, come back and share what that quote meant. And he says that, you know, after, you know, 28 days, of course, that quote meant a whole lot of different things. He had gone very, very deep. You know, even as you read the same thing over and over and over again, if it's the right same thing, and if you're reading it with the right heart, it's like the meaning kind of drills down into a deeper and deeper, clearer and clearer, more meaningful and more meaningful meaning. And so that's how Diedrich started Circle, by having a paragraph be read by each and every person out loud 26 times. And so with that spirit, I'm not going to do it 26 times, but I think I'm going to read this paragraph 5 or 6 times, maybe 6 times. We'll end with the 6. And by the way, just as I said that, I remember there are some paragraphs, if you know the teachings of Inner Ramana, there are some paragraphs in that book that the reader is asked to read like 5 or 6 times. Right? So this is a practice that the corrective aspect of mind uses, whether it's the corrective aspect of mind coming through Inner Ramana, the corrective aspect of mind coming through Samuel Williams' Chinese master teacher, or the corrective aspect of mind coming through Diedrich Woolsack, or if any of you all know Michael Langford, you know, he recommends reading repeatedly. So, you know, the corrective aspect of mind, you know, coming through many, many different teachers, seems to recommend often reading something slowly and repetitively so that it can continually and continually speak to you in more and more ways. It's the intellectual mind that wants to read it once and say, okay, I got it. But the corrective aspect of mind says, read it again. Okay, now read it again. Okay, good. Now read it again, right? So we're going to do that. We're going to, in the spirit of choose again, I'll read this same paragraph 6 times. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. All right, that is 6 times. Is there anything anyone in the room would like to share that came up for you or that you realized as you were listening to this? If so, please put up your hand. I would love to hear from you. Nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think that I am vulnerable. And nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Anyone at all? I mentioned earlier that sometimes when you're contemplating something heavily, when you're studying a certain corrective spirituality deeply, that that lays a filter on your mind through which you see everything. And I said, that's good, that's helpful, right? That's healing. And I talked about how Jay was listening to me through the filter of Michael Singer's Untethered Soul, because that's where he's putting himself right now. But since I just spent an hour talking about the ego is object focus, right? That filter went into this reading for me. So nothing except my thoughts can attack me. Well, the way that I saw that was... again, taking the last hour's teaching into mind was, first of all, immediately I saw that nothing can attack me, period. Nothing can attack me, because I was aware of the self that we talked about, which is beyond judgment, beyond differentiation, right? And obviously that self is so beyond that it cannot be attacked. So I saw first, nothing can attack me. But then I saw that that feeling of being attacked can only come by projecting myself fully into my thoughts, right? And in that way, nothing except my thoughts can attack me. It's really not the thoughts that are the attacking me. It's my willingness to project myself fully into them. Nothing except my thoughts can make me think I am vulnerable. Again, as I project myself fully into them, and I believe that story, I identify with that story, I feel vulnerable then, right? You all are talking bad about me behind my back. I'm projected into that story. I am vulnerable. It's not you all talking about me behind my back. It's the fact that I've projected my attention into that story in my mind. And then the last line, and nothing except my thoughts can prove to me that this is not so. Well, for me, that was the stepping back and looking and noticing they are just thoughts. They are just objects. Seeing them as thoughts, as objects. And then noticing who I am, what I am, the looker, and noticing that it has never been attacked. It cannot be attacked. Therefore, there is no attack happening. And it doesn't even matter if there seems to be a real appearance of you all talking about me, right? If I project myself into the story that you're talking about me, I feel vulnerable. I feel attacked. But if I look at my thoughts about you talking about me, and then I notice what's looking, and then I notice what I am, then I see it's not so. Even if the activity is continuing, it's not so. It's impossible. It's beyond the possibility of being true. That I could be attacked, right? That I could be vulnerable. Let's see, Kathy and Kathy are both writing in the room. I have two sweet Kathys. Kathy number one, whose thoughts attack and lead to vulnerability? The ego. My real thoughts show I cannot attack or be vulnerable. I am not the ego. And then Kathy number two, when I am feeling attacked, I feel attacked because I am feeling attacked. You're projecting all the way into that feeling. I feel attacked because I am feeling attacked. When I am feeling attacked, I feel attacked because I am feeling attacked. And I'm projected all the way into that, right? What's happening at Choose Again is... You know, Diedrich uses the most innocent little thing to get people talking. It's really a bit of a miracle how people are so quickly finding their upsets just sitting around in a room doing nothing, sitting around in a room with a bunch of friends, you know, people they were hugging, happy to see, sitting around in a room with a bunch of friends. And then, you know, before you know it, you know, people are crying, stuff is coming up, you know, and Diedrich does the simplest things to make that happen, like... The first thing we did was we read a paragraph 26 times and he asked if anybody had anything to share on the reading. And right then, probably because we listened to the reading 26 times, four or five people had stuff come up just from the reading. So the first hour or so, maybe beyond an hour, I wasn't looking at a clock, so I don't know. We were listening to, you know, deep, deep wounds coming up. Just from having read the same paragraph 26 times. And at some point, you know, that ended. The people who were affected by the paragraph ended. And so then Diedrich says, okay, now we're going to just introduce ourselves. Okay, and so-and-so, would you like to introduce yourself? And so so-and-so says something, you know, oh, I'm so-and-so, and I blah, blah, blah. And one thing they were supposed to tell is why they came to the retreat. Here's why I'm here. Does anybody have a question for this person? And somebody asks just, you know, a question. And you're just through this natural unfolding, something gets hit. Either in that person or in another person in the room. And now we're doing another process. Takes another 20, 25 minutes. And now, okay, now person number two can introduce yourself. You know, we were together for hours. And I think maybe five or six people got to introduce themselves at this rate. We'll be introducing ourselves all week long. But that's because what's really happening is that we aren't introducing ourselves. What's really happening is that an environment has been provided so that people's wounds can be triggered. Without anything, you know, I've heard stories of like when master teacher used to walk up and hit people, you know, to quote, trigger them. Nobody's hitting anybody. We're introducing ourselves, for God's sakes. We're talking one at a time, for God's sakes. Nothing's happening. And yet people are running to the center of the room and grabbing Kleenexes. And we're turning our attention to whoever's upset and we're staying with them until they're free of that upset. And then somebody else is upset and we're turning our attention to them and staying with them until they're free of that upset. And that's what's happening. Yeah, and Jay is writing that his former metaphysical cult leader would do harsh things to crush students' egos. Well, I'll tell you, in case any of you have ever feared that Diedrich does that, Diedrich isn't doing anything. He's letting people introduce themselves. He's reading a quote, 26 times. He isn't doing anything. The stuff is just happening. But when it begins to happen, when something begins to come up for somebody, he is turning his attention in that direction, and he stays with them. In fact, one person very early in their process tried to say, okay, I'm done. When it was clear to everyone in the room, they weren't done. But this person says, okay, I'm done. And another person says, with Diedrich, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You're not done until the gorilla says you're done. And we all laugh because by that point we'd seen that's true. Diedrich stays with you until an actual release has happened. He doesn't allow you to cop out, quit early, right? So that's the only thing he's doing. But he's not, running around, hitting people, or he's not insulting people, or he's not, he's not doing anything. The triggers are just happening through grace. I swear to you, it's grace. Because there's nothing happening in that room that should have made, eight people cry this morning. We had at least eight crying. Nothing is happening, but it's grace. This is the purpose for why people came, right? They came to be healed. And so just the fact that they came with that intention through the most innocent, let's introduce ourselves process, stuff is already coming up. But when it does, Diedrich turns his attention there. And he doesn't get distracted. And he doesn't stop, doesn't leave that person to go to another person until there has been a release. And he's using a particular process. He's repeating the process over and over. He has a process that he calls the 6 steps to freedom. And if you want to write this down, please do. I'm sure he doesn't mind. The 6 steps to freedom. Step number 1, I am upset. And the I is bolded and in a larger font in his book. I am upset. It says in his book, the first step in the conflict resolution or upset resolution dance is to own that I feel upset and to remember that this conflict is gold. Gold. I love that word. Gold. Why is this conflict gold? Because this is giving me an opportunity to heal right here. Right here. Something that has been repressed. Some story that we've believed possibly since we were 4, 5, 6, 7. And it's come around again and again and again through the conditioning loop, what I think, I see, what I see, I experience, what I experience, I think, right? And so now it's fully ingrained as an apparent fact within our psyche. This situation is giving me the opportunity to uncover that, see that, and step away from that, let go of that. And that's why it's gold. Every conflict serves a purpose and will lead to a joining if resolved. It's true. It can be hard to remember sometimes, but this upset is offering me healing. I have chosen the upset based on a belief I hold about myself, and that belief is not true. The upset, therefore, gives me the opportunity to heal or correct that belief. And the way Diedrich does that is, somebody could be upset about something that appears to be happening now in the room. Maybe somebody across the room with, their eyes just kind of rested on you, and you're feeling looked at, you're feeling watched, and it's starting to get on your nerves that this person is looking at you. You don't know who they are, why are they looking at me? And finally you say something. Why are you looking at me, right? And the attention gets turned to you because you've revealed that you're upset. Somebody's looking and you've revealed that you're upset about that. And so what Diedrich does immediately, you know, you may be sitting there saying, why are you looking at me? Are you looking at me? You know, why are you looking at me? And Diedrich would turn his attention to you in that particular circumstance, and he would say, what are you feeling now? What are you feeling? Close your eyes, he always says. Close your eyes. Right? Because you got to close your eyes and stop looking at the person that you were projecting blame onto, the one who's looking at you. Right? Close your eyes and just look at yourself. What are you feeling? And most people can identify what they're feeling pretty clearly, but you know, sometimes people can't. Sometimes, you know, the ego is so good at hiding so that we can't see that some people can't even identify what they're feeling. And so on page 104 of this little workbook that Diedrich passes out to everyone, there's a, gosh, I don't know, I haven't counted, probably 60 or 70 different possible feelings that you could be feeling. And he has people, if they can't identify their feeling, he has them turn to page 104, go down the list. And as you read the list, whatever hits, you know, say it out loud. Tell us what you're feeling. And so, you know, if I'm someone who's upset because someone is looking at me from across the room and it's really bothering me, and I close my eyes and you said, what are you feeling? And all I could feel was this, you know, this confused feeling that I didn't even know how to describe, and he asked me to go down the list. Well, I might look down the list and I might say, let's see, I feel afraid, I feel alone, I feel angry, I feel confused, I feel cornered, I definitely feel cornered, I feel despair, I feel embarrassed, you know, and I'm going to stop there, but just keep, you know, it's in alphabetical order. You just keep going down the list. And then after you list all these things, he'll repeat back to you, you know, he'll say, okay, you said you felt afraid, alone, angry. You know, you said you felt confused, you felt cornered, you felt despair, and he would continue. And then he would say, which one of those did you feel the most? You close your eyes and you look. You see, I felt cornered. That's what I felt the most. Okay, now that you've been able to identify your feeling, the primary feeling with what's going on now, he then has you close your eyes. And he says, remember, close your eyes and remember, when's the first time that you ever felt cornered? He says, don't think, just let it come. Just go deep, deep into the feeling. Feel the feeling as well as you can feel it. When is the first time that you recall feeling this feeling? Oh, yeah, I remember. It's when I was in kindergarten. The teacher had left the room for a little bit, and she told us all to be quiet. And I don't know exactly why I did this, but it's just like I had this energy I needed to release or something, and I just kind of banged on the tables. And she happened to be just outside the room when I did that, and she heard it, and she came in, and she said, who banged on those tables? And everybody in the classroom pointed at me, but I, you know, I pointed at the boy next to me, but everybody else pointed at me, and I felt cornered. And then he'll say, okay, look at that, look at that. How did that make you feel? Like everybody in that room knew that I was a liar because I was pointing my finger at that other little boy, but they were all pointing at me. Okay, you were a liar. Well, how, you know, if you look at that, what did that say about you? That I was bad. I was really bad. I was the bad one. They were all pointing at me. And so very, very quickly, we've gone from me being upset because somebody's looking at me across the room. They may not even realize it. They might be deep in contemplation and their eyes have just landed on me, right? Eyes have to rest somewhere. And now we're looking at the fact that what I really believe about myself is that I'm bad. So I'm upset. He always says, he says step number two is me. This is about me. And that little process I showed you tells you how it's about me. It's not about that person over there that's looking at me, staring at me. It's about me feeling cornered, about me having this repressed idea that I'm bad, right? And this feeling cornered is really bringing up that feeling again that I'm bad. I'm the bad one. You know, he had his focus on the feeling. He has remember the feeling. That's steps 3 and 4. And number 5, establish what my judgment of myself was at that moment. Again, my judgment of myself at that moment when all those kids were pointing at me was, I'm bad. I'm the bad one. Right? And then step 6, embrace the truth. And that's where he has you practice a, it's a forgiveness statement, which I don't know if I'll be able to quote it exactly. I'll do my best. But he has you pick someone else in the room that you just kind of intuitively feel may share this false belief with you. And this is also kind of a miracle to watch because people don't even know each other, and yet they're picking someone, and you can tell that the person they pick really identifies with their story and their circumstance. Now we're up to step 6 already, Jay. I'll go over the steps again in a moment. But so he has you pick somebody in the room and look at that person. Look that person right in the eye, and then you say something like, I forgive myself for thinking that I am the baddest of the bad. And then the other person looks you in the eye and says, thank goodness it's not true. It could never be true. And then that person says, I forgive myself for thinking that I'm the baddest of the bad. And then you look at them and you say, thank goodness that's not true. It could never be true. And it sounds very, very simple, but because two people who really connect with that belief are looking each other in the eye and saying this, some kind of a release happens. And then he tests the release, though. He says, okay, now close your eyes. He says, look again, you know, look back at that situation again. You know, look back when you were the little girl in the kindergarten room and everybody was pointing at you. How do you feel about that now? And so we close our eyes and we look. Yeah, no, I don't feel that same way anymore about that. It's just something that happened. And you know, a release has happened. You know, you've in a way you've relived a moment, but this time when you lived it differently. So something that had been repressed very deeply in your psyche is released. And that's really the process that he uses over and over and over again. Okay, so let me go over the steps again. Step 1, I am upset. I am upset. Yeah, and Lynn's typing them in the room. Thank you, Lynn. Step 2, me. This is about me. Step 3, focus on the feeling. Step 4, remember the feeling. When did you feel this first? And step 5, establish what my judgment of myself was at that moment. So when I go back to when I remember feeling this first, what did I decide this meant about me? And so it's a very, very simple little process. And it's kind of funny to watch it happen because, again, you know, one person said, for example, I don't even remember my childhood. And he said, don't worry about remembering your childhood. Just focus on the feeling. Just go into the feeling. And sure enough, a memory came up for her. A very clear memory. It just happens. So there's a lot of grace going on in that room. There's a lot of healing going on. I was only there for part of the day. I'm not actually a participant or a facilitator. I am the logistical support. So I'm only there part-time. I'm also still working here, obviously. Tonight I'm like covering for everyone and working, you know, the Awakening Together Sanctuary practically all night. I'm only there part-time, so I only saw one session. They're doing a lot more work than I'm seeing. But the one session that I saw, it was amazing. In fact, another quote that's here in this little book that Diedrich passes out, also from A Course in Miracles, discomfort is aroused only to bring the need for correction into awareness. Discomfort is aroused only to bring the need for correction into awareness. You imagine how fast your healing might be if every time you experience an upset, you closed your eyes, said, okay, what is this feeling? You immediately take your mind off of the story, off of the appearance, say, what is this feeling? Can I remember the first time I felt this? Okay, in that story, that day, what did I say this meant about me? That's what I'm really upset about. Remember, A Course in Miracles says, you're never upset for the reason you think. Well, this is just a quick process to find out what's underneath that upset. And then you forgive it. It's been repressed because you believed it for all these years. Now you forgive it. Now you say, I forgive myself for believing that that meant I'm less than the others. Kathy is asking, is it important to remember the first time you felt that? He says, trust whatever memory comes up. So don't go getting all worried about, oh, but that's when I was 8. What if it was earlier? You know, then you're going to jump back into the mind. So he says, trust whatever memory comes, trust that. Just trust that one. Go with the one that comes. Remember, grace is leading the entire process, right? So the memory that comes is the memory that was to come. That's the one to be forgiven. And what you're really forgiving is a decision you made about yourself. Right? You're forgiving a decision you made about yourself. What this means about me. That's what's being forgiven. So that's just a little bit about what's happening here at the Choose Again retreat. Again, today was the first full day. They're also doing yoga, which I probably will miss all of that because of the time of day they do it. They do it either in the early morning before breakfast or in the evening after dinner, and I'm not there during those times. I'm usually there from after breakfast until lunch, you know, so that's the part of the day that I go and see if there's anything that needs to be taken care of. They're also going to be doing the holotropic breathing, which one day I might stay for that. I've been invited to participate, and, you know, everybody who's done it says you need to experience. So assuming it works when I can do it, I will do that. But we'll see how it all unfolds. As I mentioned, I still have other things. I still have meetings tomorrow. I still have an NTI group on Tuesday. I'm still teaching and adminning here on Wednesday, so I haven't given up my work tasks this week. I'm going back and forth between the retreat and home. But Lynn is off, and I have asked Lynn to be completely off. I've asked her not to even go online this week, so hopefully you guys won't hear anything from Lynn. You won't see hide nor hair of her, I hope. I've asked her to take the entire week off and take a true retreat without checking in. So hopefully she'll do that. I think the next thing I would like to do, this is just something I selfishly want to do for me. But because I never sit down and do it, because it always seems other things are coming up to be done, I'm going to use the next little bit of our time here in our member meeting to do it with you. And the selfish thing that I want to do for me is I want to go spend a little bit of time looking at Timothy Conway's website. I just haven't had the time to do that that I would like. As some of you may remember, Timothy Conway was here on the third Sunday of April as our satsang leader, but also he is going to be one of the speakers at our retreat in Santa Barbara in September. And I really would like to spend some time between now and then just becoming a lot more familiar with his teachings and his writings. One thing that's interesting about Timothy, I've just put his website in the room, by the way. It's enlightened-spirituality.org. Actually, there's a lot of things that are interesting about Timothy. Not one thing. There are a lot of things that are interesting about Timothy. One thing that is interesting about Timothy is that he had an awakening experience when he was 16 years old while doing calisthenics without any really prior focus on a spiritual path or anything. And it completely shifted his entire focus for life. He just shifted completely and permanently. And one of the things he became, completely interested in that he had no interest in before was spirituality. And Timothy is interested in all spiritualities that point toward truth, which I think makes him the perfect speaker for our first Awakening Together satsang, because really that is what Awakening Together is about, right? All spirituality, all spiritual teachings that point toward truth. And that is the heart of Timothy's interest. And he has gone on to even get a PhD, right, and write books about all of these different spiritualities. But his real focus is and how they point to truth and how they say the same thing. And so he can speak in many, many languages, not human languages, but spiritual languages. He can speak using the language of Buddhism, the language of Hinduism, the language of Kabbalah. And he sees so clearly how they're all saying the same thing. Another thing that was interesting, by the way, was, this was an experience that I had maybe more directly than you all, was the experience of his attention. You all heard him on audio. I saw him on video. There's something that I would call very clear about his attention. Very clear in that it didn't seem to have, there was nothing blocking. There was nothing blocking the attention between him and me. I felt completely connected with. And, David Hemphill, who he's never met and who he couldn't even see, David asked a question that night, and I do know David. And I felt that Timothy somehow completely connected with David, whom he couldn't even see. Timothy wasn't even in Pal Talk. He was on Skype on my Mac side of the house, and you guys were in Pal Talk on my Windows side of the house. There was no real connection at all. And yet Timothy was able to completely connect with David and answer in a way that was completely perfect for David. So that non-obstructed attention caught my attention. Jay says he felt that when Timothy was answering his question, Timothy was also speaking to him very personally too. So yeah, that non-obstructed attention. And if I was to call anything enlightened, it doesn't feel right to say that a person is enlightened. That attention was enlightened attention. That attention that I felt coming from him was enlightened attention. And enlightened attention is always present. It's just that it's not always unobstructed. Most of us, when we're listening to someone, even if we say we're giving them our attention, the truth is we have other little ideas and thoughts going on in our head. And if you start paying attention to this, you'll notice this, that when you're listening, there's actually thoughts and ideas going on in your head. And if you really look, you're going to see that these thoughts and ideas are really about me, and what this person's saying and how this relates to me, right? So your attention is actually obstructed by the ego. Unobstructed attention is enlightened attention. It has no ego obstructing it. And it has a very clear, very focused, very loving feel about it. And that's what I recognized in Timothy. I've recognized it in a few other people that I've met too. It's an unobstructed, clear, enlightened attention. Some people call it awareness, right? You hear that word awareness more. So those are kind of the things I already know about Timothy. So let's put that aside a little bit. What I really would like to look at just a little bit, because we don't have that much time left. Of course, I can go over if I want to, because the only person I'm stepping on is me. I'm in the next hour too. It's me, and me tonight. So I may go over a little bit. Who cares? But one thing I would like to do is I would like to just start spending a little more time looking at Timothy's website and getting to know Timothy a little bit more. So, you know, he has several things on his website that interest me. Of course, the non-dual spirituality, I'm sure, is interesting, but that's not what's grabbing me right now. I think probably the three that really interest me that I'd like to spend time looking at first, and I'm not going to do it all in the next few minutes because they all have hours of opportunities within them. But I'm very interested in his menu item, religion spirituality, his menu item, healthy spirituality, and his menu item, a little further down, engaged spirituality. And by the way, just to point it out to you, if you're looking at his website, you'll notice a little below that, a few items below that, you'll see satsang-free audios. I would also love to go and listen to those audios, and maybe here in the room during open times we can even play some of those audios, satsang-free audios. But right now what I'm going to do, because that's what I'm feeling to do, is I'm going to click on Engage Spirituality. Ah, and this is interesting. I didn't even know it was under here, but it's interesting right away. It's especially interesting when talking to a bunch of course students. Engaged Spirituality. The heading at the top of the page says, healing our world, our politics, our economies, our environment. That's what engaged spirituality is. Healing our world, our politics, our economies, and our environment. So I'm going to scroll down. And here's what it says on Timothy's website. At this engaged spirituality section of enlightenedspirituality.org, we explore how the power of awareness can heal the manifest situation of all of us together by bringing divine compassion and justice to our politics. Politics, making enlightened policy together, is not to be ignored by spiritually oriented persons. Enlightened, intelligent policy making is essential for ensuring a fair economy, healthy environment, and peaceful world. And I'll tell you what this is reminding me of as I'm reading this is, you know, many of you know that Peace Pilgrim was my inspiration. And Peace Pilgrim had the same philosophy. In fact, Peace Pilgrim wanted the government to start a Department of Peace rather than a Department of War. Right? A Department of Peace. So, you know, it's interesting how, and also, you know, if you look at Lao Tzu, actually, you know, if you study Lao Tzu, it's kind of an interesting little paradox. If you study the Tao Te Ching, you'll see that Lao Tzu is asking the leaders not to try and fix the world. It's very, very clear. Not to try and fix the world. And yet, Lao Tzu was speaking to, trying to teach the leaders, which some people may call trying to fix the world, trying to change them. And I have contemplated this. I haven't spoken about it before, but I have contemplated this. You know, so do we see Lao Tzu as a hypocrite, not living what he was teaching? Because he's teaching, don't try to fix, and yet there's appearance of trying to fix. Or is there something else going on here? The something else being, for lack of better words, where the appearance of fixing is coming from. You know, one thing that I have noticed within myself is I have noticed that I do things and I say things without any premeditation whatsoever, and that what I do and what I say comes straight through me. Right? It comes straight through me. So if you're looking at me and I'm doing it or I'm saying it, you know, you'll say, Regina is doing this. Regina is saying that. But in the way that Regina used to do things and say things, it's not true. Because Regina would think and think and think and make decisions and then do. Think and think and think and form opinions and then say, right? But this spontaneousness that comes through, I can't take credit or blame for that. That's a spontaneousness that's coming through. It may look the same to the bystander, but I know the difference. I know that I didn't think and think and think and then decide to do, or think and think and think, form an opinion and say. I know that I just did, or I just opened my mouth and this was said. So what if what Lao Tzu was talking about when he was talking to the leaders and asking them not to try and fix is because he knew they were still coming from the thinking, problem-solving mind that is the ego, that is object focus. And that as they came from that mind, that continues to create the same problems they're trying to fix. And what he wanted them to do is become completely detached from that mind, to not exercise that mind at all, to not be object-focused at all, so that that connection, that object-focused connection that we call ego, could die. And then, spontaneously, honestly and spontaneously, whatever happens, happens, and it's perfect flow and perfect correction. And what if his writing was that perfect flow, perfect correction speaking? Lao Tzu never ever thought about what he was going to write. He just wrote and it came. You know, I read a poem by Rumi the other day. Let me see if I can find this poem. If you'll pardon me for a moment, I might be able to find it. Maybe not. Oh, here we go. See, not if word's going to lock up on me, we're not going to find it, but it decided not to lock up on me. Okay, what I'm doing is I'm opening up the workbook I recently finished writing for the Minister Preparation Program. And it is a course on Sufism. And I do believe I put this Rumi poem in this course. So now I'm searching Rumi. And I may have taken it out. It might not be in here anymore. Okay, nope, here it is. Okay, so listen to this poem by Rumi. It's a little bit long, but listen to what Rumi wrote. All day I think about it, then at night I say it. Where did I come from, and what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. My soul is from elsewhere, I'm sure of that, and I intend to end up there. This drunkenness began in some other tavern. When I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent, sitting in this aviary. The day is coming when I fly off, but who is it now in my ear who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth? Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I cannot stop asking. If I could taste one sip of an answer, I could break out of this prison for drunks. I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. This poetry. I never know what I'm going to say. I don't plan it. When I'm outside the saying of it, I get very quiet and rarely speak at all. You know, it's this magnificent poem that's written through him, right? Parts of this poem are very, very famous. This one particular quote, I didn't come here of my own accord and I can't leave that way. whoever brought me here will have to take me home. This is among one of the most famous Rumi quotes out there. And yet he follows that by saying this poetry. I never know what I'm going to say. I don't plan it, right? So what if that, you know, which appears to be Lao Tzu writing a book for Chinese leaders telling them not to fix the world, is not really Lao Tzu. It's just coming through Lao Tzu, right? What if, as long as we're object-focused, we need to not fix the world? As long as we're object-focused, we need to be focused on accepting the atonement for ourselves. But what if, once that atonement really is accepted, what if the appearance of saying things, of helping here and helping there and fixing things begins to happen through us spontaneously without our premeditation, without our opinions? We don't even know where it's coming from. So I'm going to go back to Timothy's website now. He says, this section will be enlarged with more essays in the future. For now, you can read excerpts from the preface of my upcoming book, Healing Our World, Crucial Solutions for Urgent Problems, right? Healing Our World, Crucial Solutions for Urgent Problems. So the question for me then is, who is writing this? Is there a person that is thinking, seeing problems and trying to fix them writing this? Or is this a spontaneous writing that's just coming in the way Rumi wrote his poems? He says, here too is a long, no-holds-barred interview from the Sun magazine. Okay, I'm going to click on the interview from Sun magazine. See where I go. Interesting title, Coming Back to the World. Timothy Conway talks about engaged spirituality, but it's interesting the title, Coming Back to the World. Doesn't that title imply that some leaving the world had to happen first? Doesn't that imply that maybe something shifted first? Okay, let's see. There's a little introduction here about who Timothy Conway is. We're going to skip that because we already know. There's his picture. We're going to scroll below that. And here we come to the interview. The interviewer is named Cooper. Cooper says, in your upcoming book, you say that in former times, one could get by with just an individual spiritual practice, but that in today's world, it's not enough. Timothy Conway. There are two kinds of really powerful, transformative spirituality. One is mystical spirituality, or the full inner awakening from egoism to transpersonal non-dual awareness. The other is engaged spirituality, working for the public good or collective welfare out of a deep sense of solidarity with all sentient beings. The problems in the world today are so immense, grievous, and dire that we need both kinds of spirituality, not just an individual inner mystical spirituality. Now, I have to tell you that as I'm reading this, what's coming up for me is this is the same energy that was behind the writing of the Awakening Together fifth core value. And when I say the same energy, because I don't feel that I wrote those core values, even though they came through me. They came through spontaneously. And in fact, I was standing in the kitchen at the bar and they began to come. And I think they were, if I remember correctly, first written on a napkin. That's how they were first written. But I could feel the energy of these core values, what was beyond the words as they came. And I felt the energy of that fifth core value. And it's exactly what Timothy Conway is saying here. There was a sense that it was time. It was time to let go of armchair spirituality. I said it's one thing to sit back in your armchair in your middle class American home and say there is no world. And it's another thing to get out in it and start helping from a heart of service and learn to focus on awareness and being just with that awareness as you appear to be serving. And if things come up for you, looking at those things and dealing with those things. And you'll notice that in that way, although there's, again, you're feeding the hungry, you're hugging the sad, you know, you're clothing the naked. There's a heart about it that is very spiritual and not about fixing the world. That's not the intent. It is a path of awakening. And in fact, Jesus talked about this, right, in the Bible. You know, we have Jesus talking about, I wish I could quote exactly, but, you know, he's talking about welcoming those who served him. And, you know, they're saying, how did we serve you? And he's saying, whenever you served anyone, whenever you clothed anyone, whenever you gave food to anyone because they were hungry, that was me. You served me. Right? And, you know, that same story, I can't remember which of the spiritualities, it may have been Sufism, that same story shows up, it's not accredited to Jesus, it's accredited to someone else, but that same story shows up in another of these spiritualities that I've studied. This idea of not just, you know, sitting in a cave or sitting in your armchair or sitting in the Awakening Together sanctuary and becoming mystically spirit, you know, mystically awake, which is focusing on the self and not being involved in the world, but this way of being involved in the world as a path of awakening. That's what this fifth core value is all about. Listen very carefully to this. We accept all forms as temporary appearances permitted through enduring awareness of self. We live this value by honoring all appearances and all experiences while continually reflecting on changeless truth. Well, how do you honor someone who's hungry? Are you really honoring them when you say, oh, it's just an illusion, those people aren't hungry? Or are you honoring them when you're feeding them? Which one really honors them? Can you feel it in your heart? That's just an illusion. Or here's some food. Right? Which one is honoring? So, you know, so this says we accept the forms as temporary appearances. They're not reality. They're temporary appearances. And they are permitted, you know, we're not really trying to change the world because these temporary appearances are permitted through our enduring awareness of self. But we honor those appearances and we honor those experiences while continually reflecting on changeless truth. So we do move about the world, right? We do move about the world. That's a part of what Awakening Together is meant to do. And a part of how I honored that in the first year of Awakening Together was with the India pilgrimage where we went and worked in orphanages. And I hope that we'll have more of that type of thing, more involvement in that way, because, you know, these retreats like the Choose Again retreat are wonderful and necessary and we need to do them. The retreats like we're having in Santa Barbara, wonderful and necessary, and we need to do them. But that's the mystical side. That's the looking at myself side. It's not the necessarily the getting out in the world side. And again, not really with the intention of fixing the world, but as a service path of awakening. Still focused on the changeless self as we move about in the world, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, loving those who feel unlovable, comforting the sad, right? Engaged spirituality is what Timothy is calling it. Somebody is quoting A Course in Miracles, a miracle supplies a lack, an apparent lack, but yes. And, you know, and we all know, even though we've all done it, we all know because, you know, because we do have wisdom in us, we all know that when you disregard a heartbreaking appearance as just an illusion, there's some type of a denial happening in us. We know that, right? We're doing it because we're afraid of the illusion. In other words, we believe that appearance is real. We're afraid of it, and so we say, oh, it's just an illusion. I don't want to look. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to deal with it. To go into it with the heart of service is a much better approach. That's our fifth core value, and that's what Timothy is calling engaged spirituality. He says there are two kinds of really powerful, transformative spirituality. See, the purpose is right up front. There are two kinds of really powerful, transformative spirituality. One is mystical spirituality, and this is where our focus has been historically as a spiritual community. One is mystical spirituality, or the full inner awakening from egoism to transpersonal non-dual awareness. The other is engaged spirituality. This was the energy of our fifth core value. This is what we are to add to the mystical spirituality. This is what we are to add to our practice as a spiritual community. The other is engaged spirituality, working for the public good or collective welfare out of a deep sense of solidarity with all sentient beings. Another way that I describe this for someone, this fifth core value, because in the beginning there were a few people that, of course, didn't understand why this would be a part of awakening together, saw it as fixing the world, which has always been something that we don't do in this community. And the way I explained it was, well, what if one of your hands somehow became all cut up? There was some type of an accident, and one of your hands was all cut up and bleeding. I said, wouldn't you use your other hand, which is good, right, and healthy, to take care of the injured hand? Wouldn't you just naturally do that? You would naturally use the good hand to clean and bandage the injured hand. We know there's somehow we're being cut off from others as ourself when we don't naturally care for them, in the same way your good hand would naturally care for your injured hand. Again, we're saying it's just an illusion. We're not supposed to fix the world, but we're closing our heart and we're cutting ourselves off. But he's addressing that when he says the reason, you know, again, it's a power transformative spirituality. That's its purpose, is the transformation, the awakening. But then the reason for going out and working for the public good or the collective welfare is out of a deep sense of solidarity with all sentient beings. The same reason your good hand cares for your injured hand, because really we're one. Your hands don't see themselves as separate, even though they're separate appendages on the body. They don't see themselves as separate. Your good hand will care for your injured hand. It doesn't cut itself off from it. So why should we cut ourselves off from humans who appear to be suffering? When we do it out of fear. So again, it's not the attitude of trying to fix the world. You know, as Jesus says in Jesus Christ Superstar, there will always be poor, right? There will always be poor. And until the mind is completely healed, there will always be suffering. But some of that suffering is placed right in front of me. And the suffering that is placed right in front of me is for me. It's from grace. And a part of my spiritual path is learning to be compassionate with that, truly compassionate. And truly compassionate is not believing the suffering, yet recognizing the oneness, recognizing the belief in suffering, staying focused on the changeless, and giving a helping hand. It's all of that together. So as Timothy says, the other is engaged spirituality, working for the public good or collective welfare out of a deep sense of solidarity with all sentient beings. The problems in the world today are so immense, grievous and dire, that we need both kinds of spirituality, not just an individual inner mystical spirituality. Cooper says, "You emphasize the need for engaged spirituality in today's world. Was it not necessary in the past?" And Timothy Conway says, he uses big words, I hope I can read this well. Timothy Conway says, "For tens of thousands of years, humans lived in nomadic tribal societies and took care of one another, sharing edibles gathered from forests and grasslands and game from the hunt. Tribes worked together to ensure that everyone had clothing and shelter. To remain viable, tribal societies had to be small, most comprised of 20 to 50 people, perhaps as many as 150 in an unusually large group. Some of the hunter-gatherers who survived into modern times, for instance, the Australian Aborigines and the African sandbush people, still have no private property and cause virtually no environmental damage. They are among the happiest, most loving people on earth. So a distinct form of engaged spirituality wasn't needed among tribal peoples. They simply took care of each other." That's interesting, isn't it? That when the people hung out in smaller groups than they do today, we naturally knew that the good hand takes care of the injured hand. It's somehow when we became larger and larger groups of people, cities, that we began to ignore each other and cut ourselves off from one another, right? With the appearance of, here was the one of the big words, agrarian culture, agricultural, right? With the appearance of agrarian culture some 10,000 years ago and the subsequent rise of great civilizations, a very different human society emerged. There was a division of labor, and societies became stratified into classes. But in a lot of early agrarian societies, people still took care of each other and made sure that virtually everyone was fed, housed, and clothed. As time went on, though, the politics of most societies grew terribly corrupt, which led to great pleasure for the privileged and much misery for the masses. In time, engaged spirituality would be promoted by all great religions in the ethic of loving kindness and generosity among the Buddhists and the Hindus, for example, or in the Jewish tradition of social justice and the Christian enactment of agape love. It's not widely known today, but around the time of Christ, many Jews were Hellenized Jews, people raised in Greco-Roman culture who converted to Judaism in part because of this wonderful idea of social justice. Judaism offered more meaningful social and religious experience than the fragmented Hellenistic world of the Mediterranean mystery schools and their remote, often fickle gods. And he goes on from there. I feel like skipping down a few paragraphs, so here I go. In Asia, Buddhists and Hindus began working more for political, social, and environmental justice in the second half of the 20th century, and these movements are growing more influential, for instance, saving trees and ecosystems from deforestation and damming, and young girls from slavery trade in prostitutes. In Latin America from the 1960s onward, you find the powerfully progressive liberation theology movement based on late 19th century doctrines from the Vatican that express the explicit preferential option for the poor and favor workers in management labor disputes. The Vatican has enunciated the social gospel of solidarity for more than 100 years. So all of those paragraphs that I skipped, I believe, were just different examples that he is giving of, you know, how religion does become involved in the world. Now, what I would say is, you know, some of that is probably coming from the right mind, and some of that is probably not. Some of that is probably what we know of as do-gooding, which, you know, the reason I'm helping you is because I'm better than you. And that is not helpful. You know, that is not helpful. But one thing I've noticed about the new Pope, Francis, right? Pope Francis, is he seems to have a way of reaching out and helping the poor that seems to come from a different place. And I think that's what enlightened, engaged spirituality is all about. It's as if he sees himself in those people. He's not the do-gooder helping another. You know, on his birthday in December, in his birthday, they said that what he did was he went out in the middle of the night. I think it was the middle of the night. I could be wrong on that detail, but I think it was. It's probably when he's able to escape that he went out in the middle of the night and he celebrated his birthday with two homeless people and a dog. A very quiet birthday celebration with two homeless people and a dog. There's something very humble in that, very helpful in that, very caring in that, very spiritual in that, right? So I think it's not so much what we do as where we're coming from when we do it. And I think that often in our particular spiritual community, we have spent way too much time ignoring appearances, being cut off from appearances because it's an illusion. And I think you guys know it too. You know it was a cutoff. A cutoff, right? To become engaged at the heart level. Not seeing them as, whoa, whoa, they're victims. Not seeing myself as I'm better than you and I can help you. But this connection that those tribes would have had when they helped one another, that your good hand has when it helps your injured hand, this connection of we're the same. And this is what needs to be done now, right? That engaged spirituality does seem to be needed now, and it does seem to be needed in our community, which is why I'm sure that fifth core value was added. We need to stop cutting ourselves off by just declaring everything we don't like to look at as an illusion. And I hope as we go forward that Awakening Together will find more ways for us to be involved in engaged spirituality. One thing I know about Timothy Conway, because he is, again, he's a speaker at the Santa Barbara Conference. I happened to ask Magdi first when he would like to speak. I just, by coincidence, asked Magdi first, no particular reason. And Magdi said he would like to speak on Friday night and Saturday morning. And so then I told Timothy, you know, we're going to have you speak on Saturday afternoon and Sunday morning. And he said, that's fine, as long as we start a little later on Sunday morning. He said, because every Sunday morning I go down and feed the homeless, and I don't really want to miss that. I said, that's fine, we'll start a little later on Sunday morning. Also, when I invited him, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but when we do the Awakening Together satsang here, the third Sunday of every month, I actually pay our speakers. I pay them, for an hour and a half, I pay them $100. And that comes from your lovely donations. Thank you very much. It's one of our expenses. When I told Timothy, of course, I invited him to come and be our satsang speaker the third Sunday in April and told him about the $100. He said, oh, he says, I don't usually take money for what I do. And then he said, but if you want, he said, I can take it and I can give it to the homeless shelter. I said, that's perfect, Timothy. I said, we'll give it to you and then you give it to the homeless shelter. So you can see that this engaged spirituality is, you know, it's something he does in the heart. Again, not trying to save the world, right? Just the heart connection of they're the same as me and this is what is needed here. Right? They're the same as me, and this is what is needed here. Now, last time I took a break, I played a song. I'm actually going to play the exact same song. But this time I'm going to ask you, after this discussion about engaged spirituality and this discussion about our fifth core value, I'm going to ask you to listen to this song maybe a little more carefully than you did before. In this song, what you will hear is there's a homeless person. This homeless person that is being looked at and judged. And the homeless person is speaking up, you know, I know that I'm a drunk. It's not saying I'm not a drunk. I know that I'm a drunk. I know I drink the poet's wine. But I am everything, right? I am God. And when you see me that way, you'll see God in everything. And this, I think, is the spirit that's behind engaged spirituality. So here we go, one more time. Denise Hagen, I am everything.
I saw you on the street today, and you tried so hard to hide. I was lying at your feet today, but you didn't blink an eye. I didn't want fortune, I was happy with loose change. I know that I look desperate, and I'm sorry I look strange. And yes, it's true, I drink the poet's wine, but I have held the greatest banquet of all time. Chalice, I am the blessed wine. I am the truth, I am the lie. I am the love that cannot die. And when you choose to see me with both eyes, soon enough you will come to realize I am everything. Youngest child and in the oldest man, I am the voice inside your head that lets you know you can become the greatest vision that you have ever seen. For nothing is so difficult as first it seems. So set your heart on what you'd like to see. For simply as you think it, so shall it be, so shall it be. I am the left, I am the right, I am the day and I am the night. I am the poison chalice, I am the blessed wine. I am the truth, I am the lie, I am the love that cannot die. And when you choose to see me with both eyes, then soon enough you will come to realize that I am everything I have always been. So here's the invitation, come step into your life. I am the blessed wine. I am the truth, I am the lie. I am the love that cannot die. And when you choose to see me with both eyes, soon enough you will come to realize that I am everything and I have always. Yes, I am everything, and I have always been.
All right, I'm going to change my hat again. We have been doing the Awakening Together members meeting, but now we're switching gears Typically, what's going on in this hour is Lynn Johnson and David Hemphill are here sharing from A Course in Miracles original edition. And neither one of them are here now because they are both at the Choose Again retreat. And I have no idea where they are in A Course in Miracles original edition, so in that way I cannot cover for them. But I can spend this time looking at A Course in Miracles. So it's kind of the spirit of what this time frame is usually used for. And in fact, today at the retreat, Diedrich gave everyone an assignment to read Setting the Goal from A Course in Miracles. So what I can do is I can do that assignment during this next half hour. We are using the Foundation for Inner Peace version of A Course in Miracles. And if you happen to have that, Setting the Goal is on page 365. It is in Chapter 17, Section 6. So if you all have your courses nearby and you want to grab it, please do. One of the things I've always loved about the course is the sound of the paper. I love the paper that the Foundation for Inner Peace version uses. And so now we get to listen to that paper. Okay, so I'm going to begin reading from paragraph 1 of Setting the Goal. The practical application of the Holy Spirit's purpose is extremely simple but unequivocal. In fact, in order to be simple, it must be unequivocal. The simple is merely what is easily understood, and for this it is apparent that it must be clear. The setting of the Holy Spirit's goal is general. Now he will work with you to make it specific, for application is specific. There are certain very specific guidelines he provides for any situation, but remember that you do not yet realize their universal application. Therefore, it is essential at this point to use them in each situation separately until you can more safely look beyond each situation in an understanding far broader than you now possess. In any situation in which you are uncertain, the first thing to consider very simply is, what do I want to come of this? What is it for? The clarification of the goal belongs at the beginning, for it is this which will determine the outcome. In the ego's procedure, this is reversed. The situation becomes the determiner of the outcome, which could be anything. The reason for this disorganized approach is evident. The ego does not know what it wants to come of the situation. It is aware of what it does not want, but only that. It has no positive goal at all. I'm going to pause for just a moment and just say that because we were just talking about engaged spirituality, this reminds me of engaged spirituality, right? That's the filter I have on my mind now, and so that's what I'm seeing in this paragraph. And we talked about a little bit about the difference between, quote, trying to fix the world and engaged spirituality. And what is the difference? Well, trying to fix the world is, I think, okay, this is coming from Regina Don Acres, so this is, you know, what I think. I think that whenever I'm trying to fix the world, I am trying to erase every appearance that makes me uncomfortable. That's what trying to fix the world really is. I am trying to erase, change every appearance that makes me uncomfortable. You know, I'm really trying to feed the hungry because it makes me uncomfortable to see hungry people. I'm trying to, you know, set up a department of world peace and get world peace because it makes me uncomfortable to hear about international conflict. So I'm trying to fix the world so that I can feel comfortable. Engaged spirituality is different. What do I want to come of this? I want to see truly. I want to see beyond appearance. I want to know myself beyond differences and beyond separation. You see, the purpose is entirely different. And because the purpose is entirely different, what will come of it is also entirely different. So again, I read paragraph 2. In any situation in which you are uncertain, the first thing to consider very simply is, what do I want to come of this? What is it for? The clarification of the goal belongs at the beginning, for it is this which will determine the outcome. In the ego's procedure, this is reversed. The situation becomes the determiner of the outcome, which can be anything. The reason for this disorganized approach is evident. The ego does not know what it wants to come of the situation. It is aware of what it does not want, but only that. It doesn't want to feel uncomfortable, right? That's why I want to fix the world. It has no positive goal at all. Going on to paragraph 3. Without a clear-cut positive goal set at the outset, the situation just seems to happen and makes no sense until it has already happened. Then you look back at it and try to piece it together, what it must have meant, and you will be wrong. Not only is your judgment in the past, but you have no idea what should happen. No goal was set with which to bring the means in line. And now the only judgment left to make is whether or not the ego likes it. Is it acceptable? Or does it call for vengeance? So, was I able to fix the situation enough that I feel more comfortable now? You know, okay, then it was a good situation. If it did not make me feel more comfortable, it's a bad situation, right? So, a very selfish, self-centered perspective as well. The value of deciding in advance what you want to happen is simply that you will perceive the situation as a means to make it happen. You will therefore make every effort to overlook with what interferes with the accomplishment of your objective and concentrate on everything that helps you meet it. It is quite noticeable that this approach has brought you closer to the Holy Spirit's sorting out of truth and falsity. The true becomes what can be used to meet the goal. The false becomes the useless from this point of view. The situation now has meaning, but only because the goal has made it meaningful. So, let's say I go to work in a local women's shelter, right, where women and children are there who have left abused homes, and I feel to work there as a volunteer. But my reason is to notice the connection, the sameness, to notice there's no difference between me and them, even though, you know, I've always lived a somewhat privileged life, and their life may have been a life that seemed hard. They may feel like victims. You know, all of these things that the world would point out as differences. My goal is to go and see beyond all of that and to see the sameness, to see the connection, to know we're one. Then what's going to happen is when one of the ladies starts spouting off what a victim she is and how things never go her way and how, you know, she didn't have the privileges I had and this is what her dad was like and this is what her mom did to her and then her first boyfriend did this and all these stories. Instead of getting caught up in that because it's not aligned with my goal, I'm going to overlook it. And I'm going to be listening to her in a much deeper way. And I'm going to hear her say, maybe, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that I'm the most unworthy person on the planet. And I'll be saying, I know, I felt that too, but it's not true, right? I'm going to connect with her at a level that points to truth, and I'll ignore her story. Not ignore it out of cut off, it's not important, it's an illusion. Ignore it out of it's not meaningful. It doesn't fit with my goal to see that we're the same, to see that we're one. So again, I read paragraph 4. The value of deciding in advance what you want to happen is simply that you will perceive the situation as a means to make it happen. You will therefore make every effort to overlook what interferes with the accomplishment of your objective and concentrate on everything that helps you meet it. it is quite noticeable that this approach has brought you closer to the Holy Spirit's sorting out of truth and falsity. The true becomes what can be used to meet the goal. The false becomes the useless from this point of view. The situation now has meaning, but only because the goal has made it meaningful. The goal of truth has further practical advantages. If the situation is used for truth and sanity, its outcome must be peace. And this is quite apart from what the outcome is. If peace is the condition of truth and sanity, and cannot be without them, where peace is, they must be. Truth comes of itself. If you experience peace, it is because the truth has come to you, and you will see the outcome truly, for deception cannot prevail against you. You will recognize the outcome because you are at peace. Here again, you see the opposite of the ego's way of looking, for the ego believes that the situation brings the experience. The Holy Spirit knows that the situation is, as the goal determines it, and is experienced according to the goal. So let's go back to my story about I go to work, volunteer in a homeless shelter. Oh, no, not a homeless shelter, a women's shelter. Let's imagine, first of all, that I go there with the ego goal in mind. And the ego goal is, you know, I want to fix things because the fact that women get beat and the fact that, you know, women keep returning to these abusive situations time and time again, that makes me uncomfortable. I'm not happy with that in the world. It makes me uncomfortable. So I want to fix it and I want to save some women from going back. That's my purpose. Make myself comfortable. Make me feel good about me and the world. And so I go and I become particularly close to this one woman. And I really think I'm getting through to her. I really think she's starting to see that she's worth more and that there's more opportunities in the world than, you know, going back into an abusive relationship. And I get all excited. And then one day I show up at the homeless shelter and I find out she's going back. She's gone back. And I hear, yeah, he's beating the shit out of her again. You know, how am I going to feel? You know, I accomplished nothing. Roy says it would be easy to hate men. Yeah, well, maybe at least some men. I don't know if this personality would project that onto all men, because I do know that there are different kinds of men at least. But yeah, you know, it would suck. It would suck. All right. Let's imagine I go into the same situation with a different purpose. My purpose is to know that she and I are the same. There are no differences, right? And I go in and I connect with her, and she tells me her story over and over again. And I recognize the fear. I recognize the fear that she's really unworthy. Right, that's what's really underneath every one of her stories. And I recognize that I've had that fear too. And maybe I even see that it's still coming up for me. I start noticing where it's coming up for me in my life, where I'm afraid that I'm unworthy, and I start practicing letting that idea go. And I'm really connecting with this woman on a heart level. We're the same. And then I come in one day and I hear she's gone back. That's not that I'm joyous that she's gone back. But I understand. I understand it's the fear. And I understand that what needs to be happening is that this fear needs to continue to be let go. And so I go on continuing to let it go in myself. And my love goes with her. And I know that one day she will learn the lesson too, because everyone will, because it's not true about any of us. You know, it's two very different endings. And again, neither one is a celebration. You know, you never celebrate when somebody goes back to an abusive lover. But there's some kind of an understanding in it. There's a thread of peace right down the middle of it that knows that everything is going to be okay. She's still afraid right now, but the truth is still true. There's some kind of a realization that's happened. The truth is still true. And somehow that aspect of the story adds a touch of peace. The goal of truth has further practical advantages. If the situation is used for truth and sanity, its outcome must be peace. And I'm going to say in this word, an acceptance. There would be an acceptance rather than a resistance. Acceptance is peace. Resistance is not. If peace is the condition of truth and sanity and cannot be without them, where peace is, they must be. And the sanity here would be knowing that, you know, she's just still afraid, but what she believes about herself is not true, right? That's the sanity. Knowing the truth about who she is and the truth about who I am and the truth about the man that beats her. It's the same for him. He has the same fear. He's acting out differently. He's being the victimizer instead of the victim. But he has the same fear, and it's not true about him either. Right? Everybody who has the fear acts it out differently, but it's not true about any of them. That's the sanity. If peace is the condition of truth and sanity and cannot be without them, where peace is, they must be. Truth comes of itself. If you experience peace, it is because the truth has come to you, and you will see the outcome truly, for deception cannot prevail against you. You will recognize the outcome because you are at peace. Here again, you see the opposite of the ego's way of looking, for the ego believes the situation brings the peace, brings the experience. The ego would have needed her to never go back. The Holy Spirit knows that the situation is as the goal determines it, and is experienced according to the goal. My goal was to see that we are the same, and I see that we are the same. And I know that she will be okay, because I know the truth of who she is. She may have some more tough times to go through, but there's an okayness about her that always exists. I know the truth. I see through the illusion. Because that was my goal. The goal of truth requires faith. And when we still think the world is really, really wrong and that these things should not happen, it takes a lot of faith to allow this reversal of mind. The goal of truth requires faith. Faith is implicit in the acceptance of the Holy Spirit's purpose, and this faith is all-inclusive. Where the goal of truth is set, there faith must be. The Holy Spirit sees the situation as a whole. The goal establishes the fact that everyone involved in it will play his part in its accomplishment. This is inevitable. No one will fail in anything. This seems to ask for faith beyond you and beyond what you can give. Yet this is so only from the viewpoint of the ego, for the ego believes in solving conflict through fragmentation and does not perceive the situation as a whole. Therefore, it seeks to split off segments of the situation and deal with them separately, for it has faith in separation and not in wholeness. You know, as I mentioned when I'm talking about this fictional person, seeing that really she's okay, even though the appearance is that she isn't. This scene is true scene, and the ego can't see it. And the only reason that I would be able to see it is because I went into the situation with a goal of truth. If I went into the situation with the goal of the ego, I would only see failure. I mentioned earlier, a few hours ago, so there may be different sets of people with me now, but I mentioned that there's someone at the current Choose Again retreat, at least when I left, someone who was refusing to participate, wanting their money back, locking themselves in their room. I know this person is okay, scared shitless that she's the lowest scum on the planet Earth and scared shitless that everybody else is going to know it. And she's too afraid to look right now. But I also know that she's okay. I mean, that it's beyond the ability to explain it. Maybe she won't stay in her room all week. Maybe she'll come out. Maybe she will stay in her room all week and won't come out at all. Maybe she'll hate me because I never gave her money back. Maybe by the time I get there tomorrow, she will be gone. She packed up and left. But I know she's okay because I know who she is. And I know at some point, sometime, somewhere, you might even have to say some lifetime, she will know who she is too. You see, the Holy Spirit looks at the whole picture, not the fragmented current little scenario beyond the story. If you look at just the fragmentation, the woman going back to the man who abuses her is bad. If you look at just the fragmentation, the person who's locked herself in her room at Choose Again and is demanding her money back is not good, you know. I don't know if you, I can't even call it bad, to be honest. Notice I said not good. I can't even call it bad because that's not how I see it. I see it as it is. I see it as it is. I see someone who is too scared to try right now. She's too scared to try. And what I've been asking everyone to do is leave her alone. Check on her every now and then, make sure she hasn't done something like commit suicide. But leave her alone. Let her be, right? And I will tell you, I know this person and I love this person. It's not a stranger. It's someone I love dearly. But I know she's okay. And I know that a time will come. And I know that even this is adding to the fact that that time will come. This apparent failure is adding to. The heart, the Holy Spirit, sees the big picture. Everyone is moving towards awakening all of the time. That's the only thing that's going on here, no matter what it looks like. Some people just need to try a few more things out. They need a little more time to get over fear. But everyone, everything that is happening is moving towards awakening. That's the only direction the universe can move in. That's how the Holy Spirit sees. But again, the ego doesn't see that way, and that's why the goal of truth requires faith. The goal of truth, I'm reading paragraph 6 again. The goal of truth requires faith. Faith is implicit in the acceptance of the Holy Spirit's purpose, and this faith is all-inclusive. Where the goal of truth is set, there faith must be. The Holy Spirit sees the situation as a whole. The goal establishes the fact that everyone involved in it will play his part in its accomplishment. It is inevitable. No one will fail in anything. See, everyone's always moving towards awakening, no matter what it looks like. That's the only thing that's happening here. This seems to ask for faith beyond you and beyond what you can give. And this is so only from the viewpoint of the ego, for the ego believes in solving conflict through fragmentation and does not perceive the situation as a whole. Therefore, it seeks to split off segments of the situation and deal with them separately, for it has faith in separation and not in wholeness. You know, we have to get that girl out of her room and back into circle. We have to get that woman away from the abusive man. Right? It has to solve the little fragment. confronted with any aspect of the situation that seems to be difficult, the ego will attempt to take this aspect elsewhere and resolve it there. And it will seem to be successful, except that this attempt conflicts with unity and must obscure the goal of truth. And peace will not be experienced except in fantasy. Truth has not come because faith has been denied, being withheld from where it rightfully belonged. Thus do you lose the understanding of the situation the goal of truth would bring. See what you lose by getting her back in circle? By getting that man, getting her away from that man? You lose the perspective of truth. You have temporary peace because you solved this little problem, but you didn't learn to see the whole. You didn't learn to let things be and let awakening happen. You continued to try and make yourself comfortable with appearances that suit what you think it should be. Thus do you lose the understanding of the situation the goal of truth would bring. For fantasy solutions bring but the illusion of experience, and the illusion of peace is not the condition in which the truth can enter. And the course I happen to be reading from now is my very first course. So I would have read this paragraph in 2004 for the first time. And here's what I wrote down after reading this section. Let go of everything and let it be. It is unfolding in perfect purpose as it is unfolding now. Again, here's what I wrote at the bottom of the section the first time I read it. Let go of everything and let it be. It is unfolding in perfect purpose as it is unfolding now. And so, with that said, I'm about to move into my fourth and final teaching segment for the night. And I think I'll play a Beatles song that seems quite appropriate right now as we transition to the next segment. This is Let It Be.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Be whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Yeah, there will be an answer, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Let it be. night is cloudy, there is still a light that shines on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be.